This is Monocle on Design, our weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics, and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. We hope you're enjoying the festive season so far. And as 2018 rolls to a close, we cast our gaze back over some of the highlights of the past year from this very show. First,
Mexico City is so rich in information and it's so dynamic that the city becomes the material library.
2018 was a big year for Mexican architect Frida Escobedo, who became the youngest person to win the commission for London's prestigious Serpentine Pavilion. We bring you our interview from her Mexico City studio. Closer to home, an iconic building changed owners.
The stone is Portland stone, like its ancient neighbours around it. It's a great quiet little space on the plaza.
British duo Alison and Peter Smithson's crown jewel, the former Economist Plaza, received some TLC in anticipation of some exciting new tenants. Plus,
the sun is shining and the lush trees and the swimming pools and the cocktails and this sort of openness. It attracts architects.
California captured. We dispatch a reporter to Los Angeles on the not-so-small subject of mid-century modern architecture in California and bring you a dose of sunshine to keep you warm this winter. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, it's been a big year for Mexican architect Frida Escobedo, not least because she became the youngest ever person to win the commission for London's prestigious Serpentine Pavilion in Hyde Park, and the first woman since the late Zaha Hadid did so in 2000. Based in Mexico City, Escobedo founded her studio at the tender age of 24 and headed projects such as La Taliera, a former home and studio of the late Mexican muralist David Alfaro Siqueiro, which she deftly converted into a museum and cultural space. Reporter James Frederick in Mexico City visited the architect's studio earlier this year to put a voice to an impressive and fast-growing portfolio of work.
On a balmy day in March, I walk to Mexico City's Juarez Barrio, where Frida Escobedo's studio sits in an unassuming three-story building. Escobedo founded this studio in 2006, but recently relocated to this clean, bright white space near downtown. She now works here with 9 other staff members, most of them hip 20-somethings drawing away on computers. Upstairs in her office, we started by talking about if Mexico's a good place for young architects.
I think it's a yes and a no, because yes, if you are willing to take the risks and create your own opportunities, it's a fantastic place because you can really get away with things, because there are no rules, so you can kind of create them. We just had to come up with ideas of how to do things, like ask for scholarships, do side projects like research. And I think this generation of artists, curators, architects, is very different probably from the previous one where you got like the huge commissions and, you know, like the big projects. And it's about like creating your own opportunities. Going to architecture was almost like an accident, I guess. I was always interested in like the creative fields. I was flirting with art a little bit. I mean, I was good at doing things with my hands while I was growing up. That was very clear. But I felt a little bit intimidated with art. It was something that was too personal. It was like there was nothing to really ground it, and I felt a little bit exposed with that. I thought it was like, okay, architecture is something that has to do with creative field, but it's a little bit more, you know, organized. It has like this purpose, this problem that you need to resolve. And I said like, okay, I'll just try, and if I make a mistake, then I will shift careers. And the first week that I went to architecture school, I was hooked. Like, it was perfect for me. It was like something that was probably more intuitive and I really liked, but it was not very clear from the start. I think it all started with this small competition, the Eco Pavilion competition. It was in 2010. That was actually the first project that I did on my own. Like before that, I was doing Hotel Boca Chica with José Rojas, and before that, I was in Perro Rojo with Alejandro Larcón. But this competition came out. That was the first year, and it was to propose a summer pavilion for the courtyard of Museo El Eco. And at the same time, I was looking for a master's degree. Like, I was still like searching. And this program came out, Art Design in the Public Domain. It was new at the GSD at Harvard. And I think it was a combination of those two that really just like caught my attention.
One of the projects she's most famous for is La Tallera. Her daunting task on this one was to turn the Mexican muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros' workshop into a public museum of his magnificent work.
It was a big responsibility. I mean, the space was already public. It was already like a cultural space. It wasn't working that well. That was what they needed to renovate, not just the space, but also the program within it, like reactivate it fully. But to me, it was more about the opportunity to return these murals into like this public art condition. Like, he was very vocal about what art should be. This is something that should be accessible to everyone. So it's a bit of a contradiction if you had like these murals behind a door, behind a reception area. So when we just first came into this courtyard and I saw like these two murals facing each other, it was like, okay, this needs to be opened up to the public space. And it was about like taking that risk of losing a courtyard, which could of course mean like that I would be out of the competition because you're giving a private space into the public. But at the same time, it was about creating this other condition where you actually get the plaza to incorporate into the project. So you lose a courtyard, but you gain a plaza. And it was also like a matter of understanding how these public buildings sometimes need to be made with very little resources and how you need to play with that idea. Like, how do you convince people to use relatively common materials, a cinder block or something that is usually understood, or like it feels like something is not finished when you have like no paint on the walls and this is a public building. So you have to convince people to do these kind of things, and eventually it worked out really well, and now they really embrace that roughness of the building.
Escobedo was also recently commissioned the Serpentine Pavilion, becoming the first woman since 2000 and the youngest person ever to get the commission.
It was a big challenge. It was like so many names were behind this pavilion and so many great projects that it was really difficult to try to come up with a new idea. Like, how do you do a new iteration of the Serpentine Pavilion when everything has been said and done? So it was a little bit intimidating at first. And then it was like, okay, we just need to say what we do here at the office. What are our preoccupations? What is our approach to space? Like, just tell our story and see how it goes. And of course, we were super surprised when we got the news that we were doing it. And we were thrilled and happy. But I think it was like that combination. Like, okay, you need to identify what needs to happen at the space, but you also need to explain who you are and what you're concerns are. Like, what is your idea of what a temporary structure should be? But of course, you don't know where it's going to end up, you know? So that was the other question. Like, okay, how do you create a space for a client that you don't know and for a space that you don't know, for a location that you don't know? So it was an opportunity to also experiment with materials, very simple materials again, because this is what we like to do. This is what we know how to do. We use something that's industrial, that's relatively cheap, that is very modular, that it's easy to find. It was also about creating this kind of contained space. So it's not just like a roofed area, it's more like an introvert project. It's creating this kind of courtyard, which is also a notion that is very Mexican, this idea of interiority, of the intimate self versus the public self. We have like this kind of duality and we play with that a lot. So it was like, okay, we're creating a courtyard inside the park, and therefore you're talking about interior and exterior in a more complex way, because when you're inside the pavilion, you're actually outside the park, but inside the pavilion. And so are you inside or outside, really? And this kind of screen that we created using these roof tiles allows for certain porosity so you can get glimpses of the park. When I talk with my other colleagues who are living in New York or Europe or even some other places of Latin America, they're really surprised. Like, oh, wait, your friends are architects? Yes. Are you having lunch with architects all the time? Like, most of the time. And we're friends. We're competing one day, you know, for like a project, and the next day we collaborate together. And then if we don't, well, we're having lunch and it's just like having fun. Like, it's not something like when you compete against each other, then you cannot talk to each other. It's a very friendly environment and I appreciate it a lot.
Thanks to James Frederick, speaking there to the Mexican architect Frida Escobedo. And if you're thinking of heading to Mexico City, don't do so without our latest travel guide to the city, published by Gestalten. It's not all about designing buildings from scratch, though. No, no. Restoring and reusing buildings has its own set of challenges. Earlier this year, The Economist magazine relocated, leaving the brutalist towers of the Economist Plaza that were a happy home to the magazine for a half century. Now dubbed Smithson's Plaza to honour the late architects behind it, Alison and Peter Smithson, London-based DSDHA architects, were tasked with transforming it for a fresh batch of tenants. As with many such revamps, though, the project hasn't been without controversy. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis, this show's producer, reports.
We are the restoring architects of this fantastic icon, the Economist Plaza, now known as Smithson Plaza. We're standing within the lobby of the Smithson Tower here at the Smithson Plaza, which is an iconic 1960s development by Alison and Peter Smithson.
Located just off London's bustling Piccadilly, the 15-storey building and elevated plaza are a spot of calm, a quiet pocket in the capital's West End. As for the views for the top of the tower, to the north are the hills of Hampstead and Highgate. East is the city and Shard, and to the south, Big Ben and St James's Park. The three-tower complex was commissioned in 1956, the same year that the London County Council relaxed its restrictions on the heights of buildings and began to grant permission for well-designed towers that weren't too close to others. But 8 years later, the national government banned most office construction in central London in an effort to spread wealth around. But The Economist managed to squeeze through the only available gap. It was built when the spirit of the moment was to build high to free up space on the ground and elevate plazas away from the traffic. It's considered a work of brutalism, but unlike the National Theatre with its large blocks of exposed concrete, the Smithson's Plaza is adorned by Portland stone. In places, it contains fragments of oyster shells, in others, the stone's pitted with screw-shaped holes. It's the same used in buildings such as Buckingham Palace, St Paul's Cathedral and the Treasury. A characteristic that's helped it fit in with its neighbours, despite being more modern.
Universally, people love it because it's a building and a sequence of spaces in dialogue with its neighbours. So the stone is Portland stone, like its ancient neighbours around it. It's a great quiet little space on the plaza, like the yards and alleyways of St James's. So usually there's something for somebody here. I mean, it was criticised by some architects when it was made as not being radical enough. They scoffed at the fact it was clad in stone. Why wasn't it concrete? So even more radical architects criticised it for not being radical enough.
I was curious to find out what she felt when she first visited the building.
That's such a good question to ask. What was my first impression of this building? As a young architect, I became aware, as a student of Alison and Peter Smithson, I saw the images. Michael Karapetian took these extraordinary black and white, gritty, urban photographs of the building in rain, with puddles and fog, caused much outrage at the time, apparently. And wow, I was so excited to see it. And I do remember coming and just loving the architecture, but finding the elevated nature of the plaza a little bit problematic. I didn't feel quite welcome enough. So I think at the core of what we want to do as the architects of today, I think there are certain things that can be improved, and that is public amenity. We would like to bring this, the best public space in St James's, to the most people, in line with what the EAM said, you know, bring the best to the most. And so I think it embodies our spirit of sharing the city perhaps more than Alison and Peter knew at the time about. They were trying these new ideas and maybe needed refinement.
So what are the guiding principles when it comes to restoring a building that's been for so long associated with a specific architect and a tenant as well?
Our motto with any project, whether it's new or old, is that we have to know more about the site than anybody else. We have to become experts. So we do a lot of active research in our studio, and we look on the ground in terms of what we can find on the site. We then do lots and lots of reading and archival research. And then we did this really strange thing called poking around the building. And we went into the plant room where the engineer resided, the maintenance man, and we found a plan chest.
Very exciting.
Pulled open the drawer and found original stamped buildings from the Smithson's office. I mean, I'm tingling even remembering it. Original design development drawings, not just the final drawings, but the evolution of their ideas from when they won the competition in 1960 through to its completion in 64. And that was a gold mine because we could then build up a sense of their design methodology. We saw the influence of the other architect with whom they had to work, called Maurice Bebb, who was employed by the client, because Alison and Peter were so young, they'd never done an office building before. And he said, wait a minute, make that tower a little bit smaller so that the public space flows better. You can see how they looked at the top of the building and they couldn't quite work out how to finish it. Should it have a glass pavilion on top where you could see inside the plant room and lift machinery in a kind of high-tech way? They didn't know what shape the bank building would be. It morphed and shifted. So as architects, it gave us a deep, immersive understanding of their design methodology and their sentiments. We have restored the building to really kind of reinstate some of the ambitions of these radical 1960s building and kind of take it back to what it was a few decades ago.
The restoration includes a resurfacing of the first floor plaza with a new lobby and adjacent cafe. But the major element of the work? Double glazed windows and new lifts. They've also gone back to a time before buildings had turnstiles and security, clearing the lobby itself from any kind of security clutter. Visitors are now expected to log in electronically.
We've taken out as much as possible and looked back to their writing where they talked about the base of this building as feeling half open and half closed. It was a kind of inside-outside space. So here you feel as though you're half inside and half outside. And we've achieved that by continuing, as they did in their original designs, the same floor treatment inside and out. So you have this beautiful stone going out from the plaza into the lobby so that the materiality of the screens becomes less. It sort of disappears. I definitely think our work will make the building feel more inviting. We think that people need to be able to see clearly where public spaces are. So with decluttered views coming up to the plaza, we put greenery in the plaza, and we know people love greenery. It's not in the main iconic spaces that were photographed. We took a lot of care to make sure that those key views would be kept untouched and only improved by decluttering. We've used this northern space, which is entirely undocumented in their archive, as a new pocket park in the spirit of those lovely urban parks one finds in New York, for example, Paley Park, to bring additional amenity.
But the renovation hasn't been without controversy among architects and planners alike.
This project was not without controversy because we were touching the kind of crown jewels of the Smithsons, kind of treasure trove, of which there's not much. And I think people express concern that the custodianship of ideas might be diluted. And it's about change, you know, that change will make it worse. In fact, having read about the Smithsons, they wrote about change and embraced change. That gave us confidence to know that our changes would be an improvement. And I would just encourage people to come to the building, look for yourself and see what you think.
With housing estate Robin Hood Gardens in the midst of demolition, the former Economist Plaza is Alison and Peter Smithson's last remaining London building. Renovations and restorations can be painful, especially for those with memories of a building's original incarnation. But over time, structures inevitably take on new life, and new tenants have the right to leave their own mark too. As I was leaving 25 St. James Street, I saw a couple sitting on one of the newly installed stone benches in the plaza. Before, there was little space for people to sit outside. Perhaps it's one of the first signs that the Smithsons' initial vision of the plaza as a space for all, a tranquil oasis to read a book or have a meeting, will be fulfilled. For Monocle in London, I'm Daphne Karnesis.
That was this show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, reporting from the Smithson Plaza, right here in London. On this show, we've interviewed the authors of a fair share of books on everything from chronicling the brutalist Barbican estate, ingenious furniture and household goods from the USSR, to architecture for pets. Woof. One in particular, entitled California Captured, is published by Fiden and prompted us to head to the Golden State sun-soaked hills to meet the book's author in Los Angeles. Many buildings on this patch of the US West Coast still stand as proud reminders of a wave of modernism that crested here in the post-war years. It was a time of optimism, space, and extraordinary experimentation. The architects and urban planners of today face a different set of challenges, but there's still something to be admired, learned, and longed for in Southern California's modernist stock. Andreas Georgis met with the architecture historian Emily Bills, author of the book California Captured by Fiden.
I mean, Los Angeles in a way was lucky because it was separated from the East Coast establishment. It gave it an aura of freedom and ability to experiment that comes, of course, out of the aerospace industry and those other kinds of wartime factories that were here. That coupled with the sort of feeling of being away and being able to sort of experiment how you want to experiment away from that East Coast establishment created a kind of excitement. This is why people continue to be interested in mid-century architecture and in the Los Angeles scene in particular. Los Angeles received a lot of military contracts during the war, right? So there is a lot of experimentation in materials and in forms, and you also have a large populace moving here to work in these factories. So both during the war, as architects were preparing to welcome a growing group of GIs coming back from the war, and the groups of people that had already moved here to work in wartime factories, to work in these industries, they're thinking, how are we going to meet this housing demand? So there's a lot of excitement about the kinds of experiments that were happening in these factories at the time, new kinds of design with steel, the use of layered plywood, all these different kinds of materials and experiments and techniques. And so avant-garde architects, modernists, were thinking, how do we use these new materials to create a kind of lightweight, affordable, something that gives a kind of ease of lifestyle that's accessible to a growing middle class here in LA. There were magazines that helped to make this happen, so Arts and Architecture was really important at this time. The publisher and editor was John Intenza, and one of his most famous projects was the Case Study House project, which was promoted by the magazine itself, and they asked different architects within LA and other places as well, but really focused on the Los Angeles scene, to come up with a kind of individual model for a post-war housing typology. And so some of the architects that we feature in the book were architects that had been part of that project. They were all schooled, or a lot of them were schooled in LA, schools of architecture at the University of Southern California or at University of California at Los Angeles. The sun is shining and the lush trees and the swimming pools and the cocktails and this sort of openness. It attracts architects from around the world and, of course, across the United States. So we're in this building on Fair Oaks Avenue in South Pasadena that was designed by Whitney Smith and Wayne Williams for their own architectural office. Williams was Smith's student at the University of Southern California, and after he graduated, they started their own practice together. And this is the office building that they built for themselves and for their practice. They were extremely prolific. They designed everything from commercial structures to educational buildings to houses, but because their practice was mainly located here in South Pasadena and Pasadena, and because they weren't huge self-promoters the way people like Richard Neutra was, their sort of legacy has been slightly lost to history. The building, it was developed as a series of interlocking volumes that sort of shift past each other, both horizontally and vertically. So you'll see there are some volumes that touch the ground, some that are lifted above that sort of shift to the side, so they're almost sort of floating in midair. And then covering the entire courtyard area and all of the volumes together are this massive but extremely lightweight vaulted steel mesh roofing system, and extends out over into the parking lot, so it almost sort of hovers over all of the different volumes. So the steel mesh roofing system serves to join everything together while also remaining lightweight and separate. And then underneath it are this open truss system, so it's really this exposure of the system of the building itself. You can see the exposed steel beams that create kind of a regulated pattern on the front of the building, and then it's filled in with these huge expanses of glass.
And then, of course, the highlight of the building is the courtyard that we're in right now, which is this fantastic oasis off of Ferrex Boulevard, which is a large four-lane, you know, pass through the center of Pasadena and South Pasadena. And it is fronted by a parking lot. So you go through the parking lot and then you step into the center of what are all these office spaces, and it's just quiet. And it's this kind of lush Mediterranean oasis that was designed, by the way, by Garrett Ekbo, who was one of the most important mid-century landscape architects. One of the things that Ekbo did is he designed the maple trees, the vertical elements of the gardening, to reflect the vertical elements of the steel beams in the building. So, you know, the columns, you can see the vertical of the column is sort of mimicked in the maple trees themselves. As you can see here in this building, they allowed the materials themselves, the kind of kit of parts that you could buy out of a Sweets catalog, for example, and just allowing those materials themselves to be the ornament or the decorative expression in the building. The mesh vaulted roof structure at the top, which allows light to come in and kind of modulate it into the courtyard. And I think they're industrial materials, they're everyday materials, but they recompose them in a way that's quite beautiful and elegant.
These cost a lot of money. Like, these are like highly desirable homes in LA today, you know, among a certain group of people who are very passionate about it. Who were these buildings designed for, though? Was it kind of like a rising elite or a kind of a luxury class, or was it something different?
I think a lot of the houses were built for mostly white collar, middle income people who were interested in a new way of living and willing to be open to a kind of experiment. Some of them had to be more open than others, depending on the architect they were working with and how rigid that architect was about how closely he or she wanted the space to be designed. I think they were also very much in tune with a kind of opening up of lifestyle that was happening in the post-war period, particularly in Los Angeles. So there's a couple things connected with that. One is the integration of indoor and outdoor space. So a kind of fluidity of plan, the opening up of plan from a more conservative model to one where there's more flexibility of space, which of course is, you know, geared in part towards the housewife, to the homemaker who can sit at her kitchen window and watch the children play in the living room, right? She's not cut off by a wall anymore. And so there's a kind of casualness to that, to having company over and to entertaining people and not having your kitchen completely separated from that kind of entertainment space. And then, of course, how the outside and the inside come together. So an architect might design it so that a wall continues from the inside to the outside, or the groundwork, whatever the flooring is, might continue from inside to outside. So the eye kind of carries in between the two spaces.
Thanks to Andreas Georges for that report from California. And that's all we have time for on this week's show. Next week and year.
Of course, the logo design, it follows the trends, like what happens in culture overall. Like, it's very connected to the time.
Can a simple logo convey a sophisticated message? We speak to the team behind Helsinki-based creative agency Kokkoro and Moi. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can pick up the latest issue of the Monocle Winter Weekly newspaper or the February issue of the magazine, which will be on newsstands soon. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Bennett. Happy New Year and goodbye.